Things on the table. It's a simple install plan. We're going to see in a few minutes that it's very common business method payment, which is apparently violates Avak Ribis. It's called 2-2-10 net 30. We'll see that in a minute. So that's one type of thing, simple installment plan. Then we also have another prohibition that is called, that is a little bit more complicated. It is a prepayment where the seller offers a deal to the customer and saying that if you pay upfront before delivery of the good, then you get a discount over the price which you would have to pay upon delivery. So what's wrong with this? Is that since when it comes to metalkalim, when it comes to movable property, the Rabbanim took away Kinyan Kesef. They said in Minatora you can acquire metalkalim with Kesef, the deposit. You don't have to give the entire amount. But the Rabbanim said that we're afraid this famous Zera Shema Yoma Nisifu Kitecha Baliyah, that if we would go by the Torah law that Kesef is Kona, so what would happen? We have the stores, people come in, they make deposits, and they say, well, later, let's have later delivery, we'll pick up later. And if King Kesef works as it does, as the Torah prescribes, so who does the item belong to? It already belongs to the purchaser because he made already King Kesef, he made a deposit. So what would happen later if there would be a fire would break out of the premises of this of the seller? So he really would have a very easy way out of not being responsible because he's only a shomer chinam, that's all he is, and he's not expected to risk his life if there's a fire. Certainly it's like an onus. So it would be very difficult to get any satisfaction, the purchaser, if that event happened. Rabbanim, they felt it would happen frequently enough. So they said, well, we have to say Kesef is not going. You have to have a Kinyan Mashiach to have. So therefore, like if somebody's giving money for an item before delivery, so it really looks like a disguised loan. But there's no obligation at all to give any money, purchasing price, until it's delivered, and Kinyan Kesef doesn't work. So when you take all these things together, it looks very suspicious. Like, why are you paying in advance of delivery? It looks like what's happening here is that it is a disguised loan, that the purchaser is advancing money to the seller who needs money, and the seller is agreeing to pay back the loan in merchandise that is more valuable than the money that was advanced. So that's what it really looks like. So a prepayment is a problem of a ribbis transaction. And I just want to mention one other one. It's called saw b'saw, which means that the Chacham said that you cannot make a commodity loan. If you want to lend someone, let's say, a ton of wheat, and the terms rule that he should pay back a ton of wheat. This is a loan, and it's a loan in kind rather than a money loan. So what's wrong with this? Why should this be prohibited? So there's a whole sugya in the Gemara and Shulchan Aruch, they talk about it. So this, we're afraid that the commodity will appreciate in value before the loan is paid off by the debtor. And so what will happen is that he pays back in coin, he pays back a ton of wheat, and the wheat could be more valuable, its price could appreciate by the time he gets around to paying it back. So the Rabbanim say, you're not allowed to make such an arrangement, saw to saw, that you have to really denominate it in money so that it's really a money loan. You could give the actual loan to be in a commodity, but it has to be denominated. I'm giving you a $1,000 loan, and it will be in the form of a certain number of the amount of wheat, which is worth $1,000 in present market value. So that's how you have to do it. And if someone entered into a saw-to-saw agreement, so that he has violated Avak Ribis, and if the commodity did appreciate by the time he pays back, he's not allowed to give back the commodity. He has to go give back the monetary value of the wheat that we assess at the time the loan was entered into. So this is called sa'a de sa'a. So there are many different transactions that are prohibited. And let's now talk about the heter iska, and then we'll see how it would fit into a lot of different transactions, how we could fix them. And certain transactions, we'll see they don't even need heter iska, because there's other factors that tell us that ribbis is not working. And remember, it's a key idea, aganata os rahman. Torah prohibits the charging premium for waiting for your money. Now, we have some other clear factor that is explaining the premium, that is going to be extenuation. But heter iska, developed in 1550 in Krakow, Nachman Avigdor's of Krakow, he's the one that developed the whole concept of heter iska, which is called the permissible venture. And it's actually a variation of a type of partnership that exists in the Gemara. The Gemara talks about Bava Siv, Daf Kuf Dal, Amud Beis. Gemara talks about a certain type of shutfis, which is called iska. Now, the salient feature of iska is that you have a silent partner who is a financier, and you have a managing partner who does all the work and the managerial decisions. So this type of arrangement where the financier has nothing to do with the business. He's not involved in his labor services, his advice in any manner. He's just simply a financier that's a silent partner. This type of arrangement, Chazal had to regulate in different ways. One manner that Chazal regulated this was that they said that you cannot set up terms that are karov l'schar, berachok l'hefsit, from the standpoint of the financier, close to profit and far from loss, which means that you set terms of an asymmetrical vision of profits and losses. That if the financier says, here's $1,000, and on my terms are such that if you earn profits, I want to have 90% of the profits, and you take 10% of the profits. There are losses. You take 90% of losses, I only take 10% of losses. That's very, very draconian type of terms. But it's just to dramatize it, that it's asymmetrical. It's near to profit and far from loss from the standpoint of the financier, that he's loading up the terms that favor him, that he's going to get the lion's share of profits, and he's going to impose the lion's share of losses on the other party, on the managing partner. So this is one of the extensions of ribbis, called avak ribbis, the dust of ribbis. Chachamim felt this is putting the managing partner over the barrels, exploiting him, making your capital available on such terms. So he said, you cannot do that. You can only make capital available on symmetrical terms. And the Gemara says, stam iska, it would be, somebody just says, here's money, betoras iska. It's a magic word, iska. So what is meant? That we should divide profits and losses equally. And that's okay. That's the way Chacham prescribed. But as long as it's symmetrical, it doesn't have to be equal. That stam iska, we say, is that's how it's treated. It's be half, the profits and losses will be divided equally. But the financier can specify that if there are profits, I want to take 90% of the profits, and you take 10. If there are losses, I will take 90% of the losses, and you take only 10% of the losses. That's fair. That's symmetrical. So any kind of symmetrical arrangement is fine. If you just say, here's money to Torah Sisko, then it's going to be 50% of division of profits and losses. And the logic of the Gemara is, the Gemara says, hi, Isko, palva milva, palva pikadam. It's considered to be half loan, half trust. And these are good terms, because what distinguishes a loan from a halvor, from a pikadon, in terms of responsibility of the person that accepts it? When you have a halvor, then no matter what happens to the money, the debtor is responsible, even if an onus gomer happens to it. That's the nature of halvor. Milvah lo hitzah nito, it's given to spend. So whatever happens to the money, you're obligated to pay back the loan. And there's no claim of onus when it comes to a borrower. He is fully responsible. So the salient feature of a loan is responsibility for losses on the part of the debtor. But in sharp contrast, since you accept something from Reuven as a pikadon, as a trust, then what status do you have? You're a shomer, you're a bailee, and you depending upon what your status is, Taz and Shomer says that when it comes to iskot, you're a shomer sachar, definitely considered to be a shomer, because that's part of your duties as a financier expects you, you know, to watch carefully. And you're getting rewarded as part, you're getting part of the profits. That makes you right away a shomer sachar. So a shomer sachar, though, is exempt from onsim. If an onus happens, an unavoidable circumstance, he's not responsible for unavoidable loss. That's so that we're saying if we're dividing our profits and losses equally, as that's Stam Iska, so we could use these terms. It turns out that half of it is a pikadon, and half of it is a loan. And that's why the recipient is only responsible for one half of losses. So that's one of the regulations that Chazal made for this type of partnership. Now, if both contribute labor to this venture, then Chazal makes no judgment of how you want to divide up profits and losses. It doesn't have to be physical labor. It could be decision-making. One person would be the brains of the business, the other one is the brawn. So Chazal is non-judgmental here. So how do you want to divide profits and losses? Whatever you do is fine. This fellow, he could be the really the dynamo of the business, he's the crucial decision maker and mover and shaker. So he'll get the lion's share of the profits, and he'll get maybe it's much smaller share of the losses. Chazal made no judgment. It's only when someone is a financier, because that's very much akin to someone who lends money. And Chazal made Gedarim fences around the Torah that we should not violate the law of ribbis. This, yes?
I'm just wondering, why would we assume that the loss of money would only be an onus? I mean, Chazal seems to be making an answer.
Yeah, absolutely right. You see, and Chazal say that the managing partner, this is the Gemara itself says about the Iska, that if he misappropriates the sum that he gets, even the half that belongs, is exempt from the losses, because it's half, you know, divided half and half, that if he uses it for personal use rather than for business, that's considered negligence, of course. Then he's hired for the entire amount. And so we're talking about an onus. So that's so. It's poshea, misappropriates the sum. But that's one of the regulations Chazal made. You can't just make something available on any terms you want. It has to be symmetrical. And the second thing they said, and which often is ignored, the things that in Het Iska, but it's just as important, there has to be a Schar Tircha. There must be, the financier must provide compensation for toil and effort on the part of the managing partner. And the question is why? And it's because of what the status of the permissible venture is. It's going to have to be part loan and part trust, because there's some percentage of the profits that the managing partner, I'm sorry, some percentage of the losses that the managing partner accepts upon himself. So that right away puts on a loan character to part of this capital transfer. So the question is, did you ever hear of someone working in a business, this is a business, and the person who is the active partner, the managing partner, does all the work, the toil and effort, and he doesn't get compensated for what he's doing? And so this looks like a disguised loan. It's not really a fictitious partnership. This is not a real partnership. But whoever heard of a business where the active partner doesn't get any kind of salary? Now, of course, it's not really violating anything of the Torah law, that this type of arrangement, because the active partner, he works very hard for himself, out of self-interest. So that he feels that this is the way he could get the capital for his business. He's willing to work very hard and not take a salary. He's satisfied just to take a profit. So it just has the appearance that this looks this is what you have to do to get the capital from the financier. You have to be agreed to work for nothing. So it has the appearance that there is a ribus payment in the form of free work that the managing partner is willing to do. Yes?
How are we defining about ribus generally?
Yeah. All the rabbinical extensions of ribus are called the dust of ribus. That's the name that's given, avak ribus.
Is it a pound like Mars iron? Or?
Well, there are things that Rabbanim prohibited that just because of appearance sake, like, for example, the lender, he may not accept certain favors from the debtor while the loan is outstanding, even if they have such a relationship that he would give these favors anyway to him, even if there would be no loan relationship, loan debtor, credit debtor relationship between them. And this the appearance is like if it can't be done, the pharesia, that's in the Shulchan Aruch sense, it's publicly. But it looks like the lender is getting this because this benefit, this amenity, because he lends this fellow the money. So it just has a bad appearance. But there were a lot of things. The Rabbanim felt that this is a transaction that is, for example, the idea of regulating the iska is exploitation. That the whole idea of a lender and a borrower charging interest is you need me, so I'm going to charge you money for waiting. So you're setting up terms that are korvus chara rochel hefsek. It's exploitation, and it's akin to a ribbis transaction. So, you know, you can't lump everything together and just say something that has an appearance. Some things really go beyond that. Rabbanim felt this is the type of thing that the Torah prohibited, although like getting around it. So there are different things like that. Rabbanim. That Gedarim, like for example, Ribbis Mukdemis, Ribbis Mulcheris is only Avak Ribbis. So, for example, there's no stipulation in the loan whatsoever. And the debtor, when the debt is due, just an appreciation, he says, here's your $1,000, here's another $200. I'm very appreciative. So there was no stipulation. This is not Ribbis Minatora. But the payment and acceptance of this extra money is Rabbanim prohibitive. Well, Ribbis Mulcheris, it's given after the loan is paid back. And then the same thing, Ribbis Mukdemis, somebody wants to soften up someone to lend you money. So, you know, so you go to him a few days before and you give him a nice gift. And then, lo and behold, a few days later, you ask him for a loan. So that's Rabbanim. Prohibited that, and you can't say just mefse, just like Maris Ayin. I mean, that is like it's like a circumvention. You know, you're paying him the ribbis in advance, and without saying so, without calling it ribbis, you're giving him a gift, and to soften up the lover himself is giving the gift. Now, laws tutorial ribbis above mavul lover. So, if you want to send a friend, and this friend is a good friend of you, and he says, I'll give a couple hundred dollars, and ask him to lend you money. There's nothing to do with you, so that is not something that you're paying. You don't reimburse. There's no reimbursement here. Then it's okay to do that. If somebody wants to do that as a favor to you, you can do that. But it can't be a connection. All right. So there is therefore a need to give schar tirchah. That's the second thing that should, because it looks like it's. Why is this fellow working for nothing in this business? And when it's a partnership, there's a solemn partner and there's a active partner, and he's not getting any part of wages. He's just getting a part of the profit. But what about the wages? So you have to give schar tircha. Now, as long as the schar tircha is, since the whole thing is in Rabbanim, that just to remove the appearance of ribbis, so it is any nominal sum is sufficient as long as it's given. Mirosh, from the beginning, it doesn't have to be a competitive wage. So in the Schar Iska form, like you'll see, the Schar Tircha, people usually write a dollar. But actually, it's interesting that now Once it's the price of a sixth of an ounce of silver, and some hold the Shulchan Aruch himself says it has to be a dinar. A dinar is 4.88 grams of silver, and in today's market, silver is over $8, so it's more than a dollar. It could be $1.30, it could be $1.40. So just giving a dollar, it doesn't satisfy all the shitas. So if you want to say you need a dinar, not a pruta, you need more than that today. The shooting up of the price of silver, So there has to be a schar tircha. And so this is a Gemara. This is a Gemara. So that's what an iska is. Now, what does that help us at all in terms of various modern transactions? So in Nachman Levigdor's came up with an idea that we could modify this iska in a manner that would make it very attractive for someone to make capital available to someone else. And because the way it is, this arrangement, it's not attractive. But it would be attractive. It has two features. One, that the person who's making the capital available, the financier, he would feel that he would for sure get back his principal. There would be no problem. It's almost like a certainty he would get it back. Plus, he would like to see some dividends, some profit as well. Not allowed to call it interest, but he wants to see some return on his investment. So that's what you need to make it attractive. So you have to modify the ISCA so that it would really be predictable that the financier would get back his capital. Plus, it would be almost a sure thing that he would get back some return as well. So the idea of the head ISCA was to do two things. To attach conditions to the profit loss statement. Because if you give somebody money to Francisco, he certainly, the financier is entitled to a statement of how business is doing. He could demand a periodic statement, a quarterly statement. And the ISCA could be for many years, an arrangement. It could be for a year, whatever term they want. But the person who provides the capital is entitled to a statement of profit or losses. So what the financier could insist is that the following. He says, well, when it comes to the losses, the only way that I will accept your statement of losses is only if you can, the way originally it was in Trumas Hadeshin, when the very old forms, and Smart quotes in Trumas Hadeshin, was Adim Yiduim, designated witnesses, only these two fellows, and they use these with the Rav and the Shatz of the community. If they testify there were losses, then I will accept it. And if not, I don't accept that there were losses, then you're fully responsible that there were no losses, and you have to return the whole capital that I gave you. So this really lends itself to tremendous abuse, because the Smart talks about this, and many of the Achronim talk about this, that right away you're really stuck with Adim Yiduim, like what in the world is the Rav and the Shatz? So how do they know about what's going on in this business? How could they testify that there were losses? How do they know about that? They have to at least be some possibility that they would know what's happening in the business. Then it's not an impossible condition. But if it's impossible, and then it just becomes a mockery, the whole thing. Like, what are you just trying to circumvent the laws of rivers by making such a condition? It's impossible to fulfill it. So there's no head to ISCA form today that will talk about Adim Yiduim, will designate witnesses. They will say Adim Kesherim. They will say the witnesses that are qualified by the laws of the Torah. That's very difficult. Witnesses that will be acceptable in a Bezdin. So that would be hard to get. And it would seem that if this is taken seriously, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein says an interesting phrase, that the head of ISCA is not a kameya, it's not a charm. It's a real document. So if you're a serious document, so you don't really want to make impossible conditions. So even when you talk about Adim Kesherim, and you're serious about it, that you say who really would know about it? You have to say, if you could start talking about what Bezdin would accept. So what about an employee of the business? He's really afraid of the owner losing his job. So it's such a simple matter that this person, his testimony would be accepted. There's no gay b'dava. He's the person that's handling all the money, and he's testifying, and they're not objective records. There are certain transactions there are oral transactions. Not everything is written down, and there is an absolutely objective record of it. So So I mean, if you look at it, take this as a serious document. So you have to maybe you would write that, you know, it's like some part of modification that would not at all smack of an impossible condition. It would put you at risk a bit, sure, but that's the proper thing to do. They're not to just, in a mindless way, to specify conditions that are really impossible conditions. So just because you don't use Adim, you do him, and you use Adim, you share him, so the circumstances of the business are such that it's the same thing, really. You're making possible conditions. So that's one feature that Rabbi Avigdor's made. The second was regarding the prophet statement. He says, well, I'm not going to believe you. I will not accept your prophet statement unless you affirm it by means of a solemn oath, a shvuah. So most religious Jews would have a lot of trepidation to take an oath that to verify statements, even if they know that they are absolutely true. They would be afraid that maybe they didn't get it right, they didn't get it accurately, and they're saying and taking a false oath. So in the olden times, people really feared greatly this oath, and what it says in the Shtar HaTisva is that if you don't want to take the oath, so I will accept that my prorated profits amounted to this amount, and if you will give me this amount, I will not challenge it, because this is what I think I should end up as my share of the profits, and if you're willing to give me the sum, I free you of the oath. What are we predicting would happen? That the managing partner would not want to take the oath because he'd be afraid of saying a false oath. Instead, he would be willing to give what is called the Shchar HaPashrus, the compromise sum, which is supposed to be like a prorated share that the financier is expecting. And he's saying, if you give me the sum, then you're free of taking the oath. Now, in terms of this particular clause of the head of Iskov, that is as early as 1977, Rav Shila Rafoil, writing in Torah Shabbal Peh, he questioned whether or not people had this reticence to take an oath as we had in ancient times. Like, you know, people, like if you want to take this as a serious document, so who says that the managing partner would not want to take an oath and say, and therefore you won't end up with what you are expecting to end up. The Shchar HaPashrus is no certainty. If you have managing partners that have no qualms at all, no hesitation about taking oaths, they don't have the fear of saying a false oath, so it's not going to be attractive. So he wrote about this in 1977, and he said he had a good idea that it has not caught on, but it's certainly worthy of very serious consideration. Like, because you look at the standard head, there are many, many around. As you said, Rabbi Yisrael Reisman, his say, I think I like his the best. They have very, very clear language, but they have not revised it in light of this concern that maybe the management board will want to take the oath. But so Rabbi Shila Rafoil, he suggests that instead of having this, that you have to affirm the promise by means of an oath, he's saying that the way we set up the business is that any decision that you want to make, you have to clear it with me. I have veto power. You have to. That's how we'll set up the business. And if you want to have independence and make your own decisions without having to consult me and have me to approve of them, then you will have to give me this particular sum. You know, this Shchar HaPashrus. I'll be satisfied. That's my. But if you don't want to give me this sum, then I want to be involved in the business, and I want to make sure that you make all very, very good decisions. You spend the money prudently. And I have to be on top of everything. Everything you want to do, you have to consult me. You have to call me up, let me know what you want to do. And that would be very irksome, usually, from the standpoint of the person that wants the money. And not always, right? But it's an idea that would make it more certain that you would end up with Shchar HaPashrus, because the person would rather have his independence and discretion rather than being supervised so closely and having everything to have approved by the financier. That's his idea, Rav Shila Rafoil's idea. But Moshe Feinstein had in his shul a different idea, and he said, you know what we could do? We could make the solemn oath a lot more scary than it is on the standard head iskal form. So in head iskal form, he just says you have to take an oath. But it's not minikitas chavis, it's not holding the Sefer Torah, you just make an oath. He said, you know, if you make the minikitas chavis, you have to hold the Sefer Torah, and you know when? Then Ashrei L'Votzim, when just be, as they bring in the Sefer Torah on Monday and Thursday. So that's when you have to take your oath. In other words, in the shul, everyone will see. So this is a much better deterrent, you know. I don't want anything to do with that, making oaths like that, you know, shul, holding the Sefer Torah before they put it back into the art. I don't want that altogether. So he said that would work. And also, he says, you could insist on the language of the head iskot, that the managing partner says, if I'm lying, then curses should befall upon me also. You know, add that in also. That should do the trick. But interesting, none of the head iskot forms really have done this at all. Yes?
In the end of the day, when you use these forms of making the iskot active, so aren't you in the end just giving them a sum of money which they didn't earn? And that would end up being good?
Okay, yes, excellent point. It doesn't say that. If you're really setting up, if you're taking this seriously, like Ramosh says, it's not a kumeya, it's not a charm, that if you put it in this form, like restructuring an otherwise loan transaction into a partnership. So if you're doing it in a way that you're setting up impossible conditions, you're right.
So even if you don't set up impossible, even if the conditions are possible, for example, if the person doesn't want to take the shtua, then you give him an extra $50 on top of what he gave
well,
you
see,
before.
Well,
it has nothing
see,
to do with the profit.
Let me add this voice. Reb Black has a very good idea. He says, you know, the remote says that this sum that he's talking about, it has to be a sum that is feasible for that you could realize the prorated share, that amount. So then you wonder that when Iskal, that Bris Yehuda says, that the Shaul HaMeshiv and others say, tremendous chiddush, that Het Iskal can be used even for what amounts to a consumption loan, not for business. A person wants the money just to preserve his business asset. Like, for example, like he speaks about a case of someone who is a Malamid and he's struggling to make ends meet. So if he has this capital transfer, then he could retain his job as a Malamid. But if not, he would have to leave his profession. So if you're preserving his livelihood, that's also called an iskah. Well, let's say someone has a home and he's pressured that he would have to sell the home, liquidate it to pay off certain debts. If he gets this loan, he could stay in his home. So this is also a business. I retain this asset. I don't have to liquidate it. That's many of the modern achronim, Chalkas Yaakov, Minchas Yitzchak, and they argue very strenuously about this. And they say that's not an iskah. But surprisingly, Bris Yehuda, that people are very much and with ferocity against this idea that this is not an iskah. But he says, Ein lo hachron. There is, Bris Yehuda says, there is no way to really come to a definitive conclusion. And we cannot just push aside this Shaul HaMeshiv and say, no, this is not an iskah. So we have different. It's not a real business, and yet we have this mechanism that we use it. Is there another question?
So how does it end up getting around the problem? I don't understand how it ends up getting around the problem with Ruben. It seems to me that if in the end of the day I gave this person $100 and he's going to give me $150 back, and it's going to be completely unrelated to the profit.
No, it's because you don't want to make the shvua. So you're buying off your duty to take a shvua. That's what it amounts to. We're setting up, so you'll get it in a second, whether this is not really a shutfus or not, really a partnership or not, that's how it works. That you have a duty, you agree to the condition to make an oath to verify the profits. Now, I was getting back to what Roy Black said. He said that it is possible to earn this amount because all the people who speculate in the stock market, commodity market, different forms of speculation. So it does become a feasible amount. And the iskah, it's best, as Ramosha Zatzal says, that not to identify the iskah, because then And again, if it's not a kameya and you want to protect yourself, say, you know, I'm giving this money for this purpose. Don't use it for any other purpose. I want you to buy a house. You know, that's why this typical reason why people would enter into head to Iskra, to get a large sum of money available to make a down payment on a house. So it's, oh, but you know, I'm afraid you can do it, you could divert it, you can use it for something else. You know, so I want to write it down. It's Dan Head Iskra does not say what you're using the money for. It just says, I'm taking this money from the financier for, and I will buy merchandise or make investments for the benefit of both of us. And this is not specified. And that's really the way it should be, because once you start specifying what the Iskra is, then you have a big problem of a self-evident loss. What happens when there's like a self-evident loss? Like you say right there, the Iskra is the house. And of course, a house, even though you live in the house, it is an Iskra, because the house usually appreciates, as opposed to a car. The older the car gets, it becomes junk. So it doesn't appreciate. A car doesn't, it's not an antique. A car doesn't, so, but a house, even though you live in the house, it is, in many neighborhoods, it does, the property values go up. So if the house is definitely an Iskra. So if you're going to say that, I'm giving you this money, this $100,000, that you should, the purpose of purchasing a home. And so then we know the home that you bought, and what happens if there's a real estate slump, and like it's going to be periodic. This is a long-term type of thing. You know, this is like really would be done in a very awkward way that would lead to terrible disadvantage of the financier if he would do it this way, head to Iskra, saying, I'm giving you the money for this boy, and maybe you'd even write the property, identify the property. So what happens if there is a slump? There has to be a slump in the 20 years. There has to be where all anybody that knows the market will say, yes, the housing values went down. Some will say it went down 20%, some it went 30%. Everyone agrees there's no profit, and everyone, so you're not going to be able to pay anything over that time. And that could be for a prolonged period of time, it could be a slump. So that's where Moshe says, that's why it's always best not to specify what the Iskra is. And you have, even someone gives you something tangible that is merchandise, the Imre Yosha, or Meir Rock says you could always substitute. And actually, there's some claim then, Menachem Mendel Avigdor said he meant, even though he didn't write it down, that this is all understood in the Iskra, that you allowed to do that. If someone gives you merchandise, you could go and substitute something else for its value. You could do that. And that's, you don't need to have explicitly to be given permission to do that. You're not bound by to make the Iskra what the merchandise that you were given. It's fungible. You could change it into something else. So because you could do that, you could always speculate, some kind of speculation, and this, whatever the Schar's Parshasam is, you can't say it's impossible, because people could. That's what Robert Black said. You know, this seems like a little not so probable, but it really makes it something that's feasible, that this amount of money. Yes?
When somebody gives another person a loan, it's based on the assumption that the value of the dollar may go up and down. So what's the difference between the value of a dollar and the value of a dollar?
All right, so the Chazal took the view that what appreciates is not the money or depreciates, it's the goods. That was the theory of Chazal. So there's no basis to lend money and say that you have an adjustment for increases in the consumer price index. And therefore, I'm getting back the same, or you can say, I'm lending you money, I want to get the same real purchasing power back. And that violates Minat Torah. That violates the law of ribbis by making such a clause.
That because they were basing the concept of money on the weight of precious metals as opposed to our concept of the currency?
Chazal took that view, and in Perakazov it's evident throughout that they took that view, that what appreciates and depreciates commodities, not Zov and the Kesef, and the question is which one is considered to be different precious metals, different mediums of exchange, which is considered to be a medium of exchange, which is considered to be the peros. See, like we have a Zov Kornos HaKesef, not the other way around. So what is considered to be the medium of exchange? Something that has currency, something that is used a lot. So we this is the whole parak that deals with that. You know, how you define currency and what is appreciated. What's the commodity? What's the money? All right. So this is essentially the elements of how you set up the head to Iskon. I want to mention a very important article. I have it in the handout from Professor Stephen Raznikoff. He has an important article. He says that he calls this a wild card of judicial review. Like, what would happen if this head to Iskon would be reviewed by the courts? What would they think of it? How they would view this arrangement? And so he says, yes, it has come up. You see in the article, it has come up a number of times. So he said he very much advises that we can avoid this type of determination that would be very detrimental. See, there's no question about it, even though it's a schutfis. I mean, that the whole idea is that we want to restructure an otherwise loan transaction to a business partnership. Well, but what is meant by this business partnership? Is it a real partnership? Does the financier, is he going to assume unlimited liability in the business? We have the principle in American law of joint and severally liability when we have a partnership. And there's no specification. You're not making a corporation, you have limited liability. You're making a partnership. So whatever business the person selects, let's say he has losses and he makes decisions that result in certain liabilities. So all partners have to share. And if one partner you can't collect from, you can collect from the other. So is that really what the financier wants? He wants to be liable jointly and severally. I mean, and he certainly doesn't want that. And that could be the consequence of it. And if you say it's going to be a partnership, that means that any payment that you that the interest payment that the fellow is making to you is not an interest payment, and which is oftentimes tax deductible. It is a share of the profits that he's giving you. So that's going to run into trouble in the tax returns. Like what are you claiming this? So he says that essentially, and that the courts would never really regard, they look at it closely, four corners of this agreement, head to Iskon. They wouldn't really regard this as a bona fide partnership. And one of the reasons is Charlemagne. He said people very often use this for a consumer loan. So there is really no business altogether. The idea of preserving an asset, that's not altogether business. And also the whole idea that what really defines a partnership, that we really specify from the beginning, this is how we divide up profits and losses. But in the head to Iskon, that's only going to come about if the managing partner, if he insists upon making a shvuah, and he brings the Adim Kesherim, then there'll be a division of profit and loss, which is usually 50-50. But that almost never happens. He's always going to take the shvuah, and he's not going to take the shvuah. He's going to pay the schar hispashrus, and he's not. He said, "I don't have the Adim Kesherim to prove losses." So that's not a business partnership where you're specifying division of profit losses. This is almost never going to come about. So what are they really doing here? Like, what would the courts really think that's going about here? He said they would regard this as, and actually we should say it, as was what is called a non-recourse loan. I mean, when you lend somebody money in secular law and you don't make any kind of collateralization, saying if you don't pay, so I'm not going to come after you. But that's not what we. What would you say? That's a really important little critique of his notion, because that's not how we would view the ISCA arrangement. Because what would that be if that's really what we want to do? That it's a non-recourse loan. It's like it's you know what it is. It would be ribbis tzadechon. He's saying that. The idea is, actually it's better than Rivas set out, because you say that if the end is resulted, there's no lien at all on any kind of property so that you have. So then you really are not a debtor. And that's very important view that many people rely upon. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that a corporate debtor is no prohibition for the corporate debtor to agree to pay, the Jewish corporate debtor to pay ribbis. Because how we define a debtor, afilu blima malkaspe, that there's a shibo, that you have to, if you don't have money, you have this misagrim alchov, there is no such a thing as really as bankruptcy and personal debt. So you have really a big shibud. And if you're saying Marosh that if there's that I'm only responsible to the extent of my investment, that's it. That's what limited liability of a corporation is. That is not a debtor in the Torah's viewpoint. So if there's no prohibition for a corporate debtor to agree to pay interest on a loan, and the agreement itself is fine, and payment and collection is fine. That's what he holds. Many dispute him. Many of the modern poskim, the Chalkas Yaakov, Menachas Yisrael, a lot of them dispute Rav Moshe, but many people rely on this. And that probably is what Professor Resnikov means, you know, that it could end up the person not really returning anything, any of the capital and Lomi Boy, the profit. So if that's a distinct possibility and it's that's conceded and recognized and by the financier, so then you don't really have a real debtor. So that would be very helpful to revive Hedra Isco to say that. And it's the, he calls it the wild card of judicial scrutiny. They might decide to, this makes it a sure thing that they won't say, that the court will not say it's a partnership. It's unlikely anyway they'll say it's a partnership. But this way we could feel much safer on that by saying that this is what we want to accomplish, that in the secular world it would be regarded as a non-recourse loan, and we call it shutfus. So that should be enough. That type of language would be a very good protective language in the head iskar, that we wouldn't have to worry that, and just imagine it, if somebody has a business to get money, and the person, the financier who gave money for head iskar, becomes a real partner in this business, and this fellow, let's say, incurs many millions of dollars of liability. He generates, let's say, he violates the Environmental Protection Agency's laws, and he's fined tremendous sums of money. So you have to, the financier will also have to share in all these fines, or he gets into various deals and huge debt. So you're a partner in the business. And these are a frightening type of possibilities, you know. So you don't want to be in any way regarded as a partner. So you want to be called shutfus, and the secular law, like what really you're doing is a non-recourse loan. That's, and I think that's a good term, because it's but it would follow Rav Moshe, his idea that you're not a real debtor because you don't have this full responsibility. Okay, now let's look at different transactions which would work. That you might want to use a het iskol. The first one is a very important one because it's used all the time in business. It's called 2 net 10 30. It's called 2 net 10 30. And the way it works is that you want to sell someone merchandise in your business, so you have an invoice and you have a sum of money that is written on the invoice. Let's say $2,000. That's what's written on. So the terms of the invoice say that if you pay the sum written on the invoice within 10 days, you can subtract 2%. You get a 2% discount from the sum that's written on the invoice. And if you don't pay within 10 days, then that you have to pay the sum that's written on the invoice, and you have 30 days to pay. Another 20 days to pay the bill. But if you miss the 10-day window, you don't qualify for the 2% discount. Instead, you have to pay the sum that's written on the invoice, and you have until 30 days from the time that it was written to pay. And of course, you may be worse, but may say also about penalties after the 30 days. That makes it even worse, but that's not a standardized thing. I don't know if they do that commonly, right, what happens after the 30 days. But this is really like a two-tier price system, apparently, that you're saying a cash price, which is the 2% discount and paying now or 10 days, and then the credit price, what you pay beyond the 10-day window. So what is a halacha if some merchant makes a stipulation with a customer and says that I have a two-tier price system for you. If you pay now, this is the price, and if you want to have an extension of time, I'm going to pay you a higher price. So this lachor is of a grievance. This is an installment plan. So in an interesting way, it's so commonly used, this 210 net 30, that many people want to defend it and somehow show that it doesn't. It's not this your vanilla variety installment plan that would really be a clear-cut violation of a grievance. So one idea is that the Chochmas Adam says that if some one instance, a two-tiered system is permissible, and that is when the fair market value of the item is the credit price rather than the cash price. That, in other words, that is really what the quoted price is. And if you can view it that way, that the fair market price is the credit price, which would have to mean that everybody pays late and this is what the fair market price is. And if you want to pay early, then you get a discount of 2%. Then it's just like what the Gemara says, that you're allowed to make a discount for rent, because you pay at the end of the month. Point to the Gemara, in our minute is just you pay the first of the month, but the Gemara says that's how you pay rent. So it's only due at the end of the month. So if you want, the landlord could say that if you want to pay me earlier, I'll give you a discount, because it's not due until the end of the month. So you view the cash price and the early price as a discount from the real price. So then maybe you could do the same thing, just like the Gemara says, you could do the rent, so you could do the same thing. Same thing with a worker, that Gemara says, that once he makes a kinyan, the worker, Schal's halacha is the kinyan, so then the schiris was due when the job is finished. So you make a deal, pay less, give me advance payment. So there's nothing wrong with that. That type of two-tier system, when the real market value, fair market price, is the credit price, but the only one that holds that clearly, that you could do that, is the Chochmas Adam. And there is, in Sefer Divrei Sofrim, he takes the view that Chochmas Adam only would say that if the seller would explicitly tell the buyer. There's two things really you have to have, that it's really so, that it is the fair market price, and then you say it also, you have to tell them that. Then you could have this two-tier system. But the problem is that the price, the fair market price, is really the sum that's written on the invoice. And you ask all business people, if that's what the price is, and you can't. So it's to say I'm sorry. I mean, the cash price is really the price. And this is really what you get for waiting. You have to pay a premium for waiting. That's how business people look upon the two nets. The price that you pay after 10 days or after 30 days is a premium of what the price is. That's how most business people look upon it that way. So it's really difficult to say without a head to isco. Now, head to isco works very well with this thing. As I mentioned before, that only the Chochmas Adam said this is permissible. Like, there's a whole slew of Achronim that disagree with that. Like, the Pische Tshuva brings Tferes Lamosha, and there's Imre Yosha, and there is the Shulchan Aruch Harav, and there is Maram Shik. They all don't disagree with this idea that this legitimizes a two-tier system, that one the price of the credit price is the fair market price. It doesn't make a difference. If there's one price for immediate payment, one price for later payment, it's a matter of semantics, what you want to call it. It's still on a Rabban level. It's not Derech Halvah, it's Derech Merkel-Merkel. So there's no heter altogether. So to rely on this is really very difficult. To say, rely on the Chochmas Adam when he's probably the only one that says that. that because if Lamaisa, if there is a price that is a cash price and the other price is price that you pay if you have to wait, it's agonata. That's what it is. You can't get around that. So it would seem that you should use a head to Iskov for this thing. When Jewish customers, you should use it for this. It really lends itself very easily to the head to Iskov because the way it's set up, it's a little variation of the standard one. The way it's set up is that you tell the customer acknowledges that he received money from the investor, which is the goods, and then of course he's supposed to use that, the OSIC in business. And let's say it's something, a consumer item, like it could be a washing machine. So you have to write the head to Iskov so that you say you have a right to substitute its value, some other buy merchandise where you have merchandise. That's a very important point to make, because what you're getting from the investor is a washing machine, could be. It could be some other, an air conditioner. So this is not a business asset. But we know what the value is, and you can substitute something else and transact business, even buy stocks. And you say you're going to be transacting for the benefit of both of you, and you say different periods of time for payment, of saying that if you report payments, if you're going to pay, give the share of the profits that is due the investor within 10 days, then if you give him this amount of money, he accepts this to be his pro rate share, and you don't have to make a shvuah. Then if you want to give him his share of the profits 30 days, then it's a different tzaras pashas. And then you could add even this additional amounts, because you're going beyond 30 days, like you want to realize an additional sum because of, so you're waiting some more. So with the head ISCA mechanism, it lends itself very nicely to different time periods when you want to give the prorated share of the profits to the investor, that if you give him this sum, you're exempt from the shvuah. If you don't, then each sum is going to be bigger, of course, as you go through time. Question?
What is the cash and the credit payment, and also how do most people view, which most people say that the -2% is the actual value, or the
people would say that the price actually is the cash price.
So what does that mean?
Because you know, there's a sum that's written on the invoice. It's a sum, and people would really say, and you know what that is, that's the credit price, and the for waiting for 30 days, but the fair market value, the price is really, you subtract 2%. So it's just a simple thing. There's a price you pay what you pay immediately, and there's another price that you pay if you make the guy wait for 30 days.
Okay.
So it's most achronim say that it doesn't make a difference what people regard as the fair market value, whether it's the credit one or the fact is there are two prices. One, a price that you're subject to if you pay immediately, and the other if you wait. And that's the whole concept of ribbons, agonata, you're waiting. So you mentioned the Maram Sheikh, for instance, and Shulchan Aruch Rav, and they all, many achronim did not agree with the Chokhmas Adam. And it really lends itself very easily to head to Iskot, to do this 210 net 30, to fix it up and make it a very simple document and do all the Jewish customers to deal with that. Let's do another case here. A lot of magazines, what they do is they tell you that if you will order a subscription for 1, 2, or 3 years, they will give you a very deep discount from the newsstand price. Right? Now, this type of arrangement apparently is a prepayment. You're paying them before the magazine is delivered. It's really a tov shlobo olam, the magazine, right? It's until it's published. So you're really paying before the good exists. Now, you're getting a discount, a much lower price you're getting. So this apparently violates a prepayment discount. And the Gemara says that the only time this would be permissible is if you have the two types of mechanisms that would allow this. One is if the article that you're dealing with is not a standardized article. So in that case, the Rabbanim did not object and say that it's okay to go give a person a more favorable price if he prepays before delivery. Because since the article that you're talking about is not standardized, it may turn out that what you actually deliver is worth the money that you pay, and it's not overpaying in respect to the initial payment. The merchant has to just turn out to be equal to that. It doesn't have to be a greater value. If it's a standardized item, then it's evident that then it really has the appearance that it's a disguised loan, because what you're going to be shipping him later is going to be of greater value than the money he advanced you. But if it's a non-standardized item, it doesn't have to necessarily turn out that way, that each item is slightly different, and some of them are better than others, more valuable. So it could turn out that what you ship the person is worth the money that he gave in advance. He got no great deal. He didn't get any kind of bargain, the fact that he advanced the money. It could turn out that way. So Rabbanim don't want to make life just onerous for the sake of making it onerous. No, they only want to put a gedarim around the Torah. So if they didn't object when it's a non-standardized thing. But that doesn't fit into our case here, because the magazine, once it comes out, it's a perfectly standardized thing. Each issue is all the same, exactly the same, right? It's a standardized thing. Yeah.
The quality of the content could be different.
All right, but that's a good point. I'll bring up, remember, in a second. When you're dealing with encyclopedia supplements, or you buy encyclopedia, and if you wanted to get, now they're online, so this is like a little old-fashioned thing, but then with the point that you made, it's excellent, because you know, you buy the supplements in advance, it's 6 years, so you don't know each one, one could be 30 pages, one could be 150 pages, one, right, you don't know what you're getting, you know, when you buy Newsweek, something like Newsweek, Time, so they're all the same, more or less. You know, you can't say that you're not going to get. You know, it's what you're saying really is the idea of a risk when you're paying in advance. The Gemara says, "Masha Izai Cholovos." The Gemara talks about in Bavosia, they pay in advance, and I'll deliver over periodically. I'll deliver you milk milking of my goats. I will deliver you milk, let's say over a two-week period. So you give me the money in advance. So you don't know that he's getting a good deal, the fact he's getting advanced, because you don't know how much milk the goats will produce. We can't be sure. So it could be that the guy is getting a better part of the deal. It's not the customer who's paying in advance. It's the owner of the goat that's getting a better part of the deal. So we don't know what the productivity of the goat will be. So that's what you're saying, really, about the magazines. That there's a risk involved, you know, in other words. So, but I would say that when you have a very well-known magazine, they have a reputation, and they don't. It's the same quality, and you can't have tinnitus that the news is boring. It's not as interesting as the previous one. That everyone accepts that. But I don't know. You call that risk when you deal with that situation. I mean, encyclopedia supplements, I agree with you. Don't know what you're getting altogether, but the magazine. So it's a standardized case that once the issue comes out, then all of them are the same. It's a homogeneous thing, and that heter does not apply. So the other one is yeshlo, Lisa Gemara says, if it's a standardized thing and the seller has the item right now in his warehouse, and he at least has access to it. He might not have the key. Son may have the key to the warehouse. That's good enough. Or maybe missing two malachos and needs to be processed further. That's also considered to be yeshlo. It's good enough. But the Rabbanim, they didn't want to make life difficult. If yeshlo, you view it as if it could be delivered now without later time, and there's no benefit that the seller derives, because he has it right now. He has the ability to deliver it now. But that would not be the case of the magazines either, because it's a dovah shloba olam. He doesn't have it. The news doesn't even exist. It's on the most fundamental level, dovah shloba olam. You can't say yeshlo, but he has the article ready to deliver, and it just needs to be processed a little bit more. There's nothing. There's nothing there. So how would this work? It's a prepayment before delivery. You're giving him a discount from the new stand price, and it's a standardized item, and the seller, the publisher, does not have it at the time that he makes the deal. So horror, you can't make such a deal with the customer. They'll give you these deep discounts from the new stand price if you're giving him money in advance. But here's the key. The Briskewood talks about this. The key is that what is the prohibition of rivets? It's agonata, or Torah prohibits the taking money for waiting. And really, what are you paying? In his opinion, and this is very much in consonance with what modern business practice. Like, why? What's the motivation that they do this? They give you this discount from the newsstand price. They want you to commit yourself to buy this magazine for a long period of time, because you have someone who just buys a newsstand. You go and look what's on the cover. Oh, you know, this week I'm going to buy Time because I like the cover story better, and I'm not going to buy Newsweek and buy U.S. News and the World Report. Every week I might buy a different one, whatever catches my fancy. But by taking a subscription, so I'm committed to buy this one for a year or two, so that is worth it to them. So what they're doing is they're giving you an incentive to stick with them for a long period of time. So what are they giving the discount for? Because you give them early use of the money before it's due. There's agonata, that's they're giving you a reward for giving you the disguised loan, and they're giving you a premium, an interest on loan. No, it's not. That's not what's going on. They're giving you an incentive to use this to buy their magazine for a long period of time. That's what Rav Bloy says in Bris Yehuda, Rishai Yaakov Bloy. And so I think you can take a little further.
I thought it was because of the advertising.
Oh, that's, I would want to say that. That's my, so Rav Ezra, that's exactly what I wanted to say. That beyond what Rav Bloy says, that if you can show the advertisers circulation figures, that's how you can get a lot of money. So, you know, you're doing this for a totally different motive, not that you want to get early use of the money and you're willing to give interest to the customer. That's couldn't be more rough what your motive is. You want to be able to show potential advertisers, look at my circulation figures. These are my subscriptions. That's solid evidence that you have a viable enterprise, that you have subscriptions. It's just you have to depend upon the whim of the customer to pick it up with a newsstand. That's not going to be very looked upon very favorably by the advertisers. So it's the same idea as Rav Bloy, but add to it that is, like, in sharp contrast, you see, let's say you have a person who owns a gasoline station, and he says that, you know, if you pay cash, this is the price. You want to pay your credit card, so then you have to pay a higher price. So you, there's no incentive here. You can't say incentive that in terms of people who want to carry on a wad of bills or something, so he's giving you, you can't really legitimize this as this two-tier system, a gasoline station, they're owned by a Jewish person and offering it to a customer, like that's what he's doing. It is simply that he has to wait for his money, that's all. And he wants to have be rewarded for a premium for waiting. That's what the Torah prohibits, agadata. That's really what he's doing. It's not, and here it's just the opposite. Here the publisher wants to give the consumers an incentive to use his magazine on a long-term basis and get also an advantage with the advertisers.
I mean, the problem is like Torah journals or the like.
Oh, okay. That I think is not a problem altogether, because the Rambam brings down Rashba, that it says all. He saw the Gemara talks about Moss Yisomim, and it also includes a Moss of Talmud Torah and any Moss of a Beis HaKnesses, that they are permitted to engage in Avak Ribbis transactions. So anything like the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society has the same kind of arrangement. They have the subscription, but it is one of the sources of income for Rabbi Jacob Joseph Yeshiva. So It is a motion of Torah, and they're allowed to propose an Avak Ribbis transaction that favors them. But if you're in a for profit magazine and you're dealing with these, like, in other words, the Jewish Press is for example is a profit organization. It's for profit. It's not a motion of Torah, or I mean they disseminate Torah very very nice, you know, but it's not. It's simply but I don't think it's a problem. Rabbi Bloy talks about it, so it's not a problem at all to offer subscriptions like this. Yes.
As far as the two-tier system with a cash versus credit card at a gas station,
yeah.
To the extent that the credit card company doesn't pay the full amount charging the credit card to the gas station owner, let's say if a credit card company, I thought they paid like a discounted price. For example, let's say I charge $10 on my credit card, they only actually paid the store $9.50, I thought, or something like that. There's some kind of deduction. So
yeah, I mean, there's a certainty. That doesn't answer the question entirely, because there is, you have to pay the credit card company a fee for doing this for you. That's true. But the premium that they charge for the credit card is way beyond that. So that's the problem. And then there's the whole problem of how you would allocate this. It's a fixed fee. How would you allocate this? How would you know in advance how many people are going to come to you, you know, and how to allocate it in a fair way? So it really goes way beyond the additional cost that you want to pass on to the customers. You're charging them for waiting, because you have to pay a fee to the credit card to do this for you, but you want to be compensated for waiting. So that's agonata. Okay. Now here is a financial transaction that is surprisingly a saw type of transaction. It's called selling short. People do the speculators doing it. What selling short is when you sell a security that you don't own at all. And let's say 100 shares of Microsoft, you want to sell it. You don't own it. So why would you want to sell the security before you own it? And how are you going to do that? You'll have to borrow it from someone, and you sell it. You think the price is going to go down. So what you do is you borrow these shares and you sell them immediately, and you're hoping that price will go down a lot. And then you buy it back and you return the shares that you borrowed to the lender. And you make a profit because the selling price is higher than the borrowing price. So you're selling before you're buying. That's what selling short means. Now, this really is a saw-by-saw transaction, right? Outright, because what you're doing is you're borrowing shares of stock, which is not money. You're borrowing something that would have to be classified as payrolls, shares of stock, 100 shares of stock, and you are agreeing to return it. It's a saw the saw. I will return you these 100 shares, and what I'm hoping by the time I have to return them, then I will be able to buy them back and return them to you. Because I'm agreeing to pay you back in kind. I borrowed you 100 shares. I'm not going to give you back the same 100 shares. I'm going to give you 100 shares back. And I could acquire that at a much lower price. The price goes down. And then I make a profit by selling the shares that you lend me and then buying them back in the market when the price goes down. And that's how I make money. Right? So this is a selling short is a saw of a saw transaction. And what is the halacha, saw of a saw? It says in Shulchan Aruch that if you agree to a saw of a saw transaction and it turns out that you're not allowed anymore, this transaction itself is prohibited. And there's a consequence of entering into it that if it turns out that the reason I mentioned before, the Chazal prohibited it, is because they're afraid, Shemit Tisyakir, maybe the price of it, or the commodity will go up, and you will return something more valuable than you borrow. So, I mean, here, you are hoping the price will go down, but the transaction is itself prohibited. And, let's get in one second. And the problem, though, also is that it's very widespread, this problem, because who is the source of borrowing the shares? So it is, one possible source is the brokerage house. All the brokerage houses, they have an inventory. They have shares of many, many different companies. So if somebody calls them and says, I want to sell short this Microsoft. They say, okay, we have a lot of shares that we own at Microsoft, and we could lend it to you. So the brokerage house could become the source of the loan. And if it's a Jewish brokerage house and the customer is Jewish, then you have a problem. So if so, that this is payrolls. But it's much deeper than that, because anyone that buys stock on margin, that most people that are speculators, they don't pay fully for the stock. They only pay 10%, let us say. So the rest You want to buy a stock that has a value, let's say, of $100,000. You're only going to put down $10,000. And the rest will be lent to you by the brokerage house. And you will have to keep your outstanding debt fully collateralized over the term of your ownership of the stock. In other words, the stock goes down, so then you will have to add, again, what's called a margin call. You'll have to add so that at all times they have on your account an account equal to the value of stock at the time that you bought it. So if the stock itself, which is the collateral, is going down, you will have to come up with more money. And if you don't, they have a right to liquidate your stock, you know, to recover the loan they gave you. So this is called a hypothecation agreement. And when somebody buys on margin, he's agreeing that if the stock comes under collateralized because you are the stock is going down, that you have to increase your account. And if you don't, you are agreeing in advance that allow the brokerage house to sell the stock to recover as much as they can of the loan they made. That's one thing. But a lot of customers, they don't realize you sign different pieces of paper, you know, in the brokerage house. You don't know what you're signing altogether. Besides signing this hypothecation agreement, you're also signing, giving the brokerage house the right to lend your stock to someone else. Well, why do they have to lend their own stock if somebody wants to sell short? They have a whole bunch of customers, a whole pool of customers that bought stock on margin. And these customers say, you know, I give you the right to sell the stock, dump it in the market in case I can't meet my margin call. I guess the stock is going down, I can't add to the account. I give you the right to sell it. That's one thing. Yadwal al tahtona, that you could sell it. And also, if you want, you could lend it out to somebody else. I give you the right to do it. It's my stock. And you could lend it out to another customer that wants to buy the shares on margin. So, to another customer who wants to sell short, you could lend that customer the stock. So what happens if there's a lot of Jewish customers? So the source of the loan of the person who wants to sell short could be the brokerage house. It could be another customer that's Jewish, right? So I think this is definitely a problem. So in selling short in Jewish brokerage house. So Heta Iska would, of course, be the solution, because you would take the stock that you that you would monetize it and then get it out of the way, and you would be involved in receiving money from an investor for the purpose of buying merchandise and you would have all the clauses of Heta Iska there, so that this would not be an issue at all. It would not be by putting it in the form of a Heta Iska, the whole thing.
We're assuming that it's not considered, that we won't rely on those shittas that are initially, yes, it's okay.
What shittas?
Doesn't the Mordechai quote like the Tshuva of Rashi or something?
Oh, we don't rely on that altogether. No, definitely not. No, that's really, first, we don't even know what Rashi means exactly. No, that is shita is not relied on at all. No, Rashi that Rivas Aydei Shliach is not. No, we don't rely on that at all. Yes.
If you're using a non-Jewish brokerage firm, you can still be borrowing the Jew.
Right. That's right.
Well,
could be.
Right.
There
is in that case. So assume that any person could be a Jew.
See, I guess when you're dealing with a non-Jewish broker and like it's a national firm, so you could go rely on a very strong robe that the person that would be lending it to you. It's written in street names, so you'll never know who it is. So you could rely, it's like an anonymous thing. You don't know who it is, but that's how they do the selling short. You get the stock on the street name. Not your name is not on it. So that's how they have the right to sell it off, you know, and when you buy in margin. So you could probably rely on the fact that the great majority of the customers are non-Jews, and you really can't easily identify who the source is altogether. So you probably could rely on it. But in a Jewish firm, a small, that has a lot of Jewish customers, there definitely seems to be a problem.
How would one formulate the Hederiska regarding the stock loan?
Well, whatever money that you got, you take that as the iskar and you substitute it for some, whatever the value is to agree to transact some merchandise.
In this case,
so, you know, in other words, the person sees this very important thing that what you are doing, this is also part of the original head to iskar of Nachman Levigdor, that you are mishabed all your different businesses to this venture, and whichever one is the highest performing, that's the one that you will that you're giving a share to the investor. So most people do have many different. If you have a bank account, and people have a home, the equity goes up. You know, the value of the home goes. There's different things that people have. Many people have that will be considered to be an iskar, and they're all obligated to this particular agreement with the silent partner, that he has a share in a prorated share in all your businesses and all the ones that you will acquire also over the ISCA term. Like it could be, let's say, a year, you could be acquiring different things. This works very well. Somebody that is a speculator that buys different financial instruments. But many people, it's a simple bank account is definitely a business that you're earning money and you're making sure. But the interest rate is very low. But the point is, if you don't really make up front what the ISCA is, you don't identify it, that's the way to go in order to make this work. But once you start identifying the ISCA, then we have to examine how that particular venture performed over this period of time. And then get into this problem, the self-evident laws that you can't impose on someone who knows. The idea of the Schach's Pashtun is that you have a chuyev to make a shvua, and you're buying off your duty by agreeing that I'll pay you this sum because this is what probably it amounted to, and you're agreeable to that. But if I have no duty to make a shvua because you can't impose, it's a shvua shav, you can't tell someone to make a shvua, I'll even shvua even. Like it's a self-evident law, so you can't do that. So if you have no right to impose a shvua, then that the Schach's Pashtus is not triggered at all. So as long as you don't identify what the ISCA is, and it says you did get something from this brokerage house, something, and you monetize it, you put a value on it, and you say that you agree to transact in a business venture that is equal in value to this that you got from them. So how would we start off with the security that you sold? That's how it all starts off. What is its value when you dump it? That's how it starts off. You borrow someone's shares and you sell it. So that's the question: is what is it worth at that time? That's the iska that you receive from them, and you agree to transact with a value that is equivalent to what it was worth, and it could be other merchandise, other ventures of businesses. All right, now here's another thing. Probably the most widely used thing that we have for use of Heta Iska is a mortgage. Like when somebody wants to buy a home, so you have a private mortgage, but it's not from banks. The person, the seller, selling the house, let's say, for $1 million, and he will not get, he'll just get a small amount of deposit from the customer that buys it, and he wants to get payments over 20 years, let's say, and it's going to be much more than $1 million because it's like an installment thing. So that is really a big problem. See, here, it's the idea that you got the ISCA is the home, and then you say I got an ISCA that's worth $1 million. And then I say, well, I can go and substitute something else and transact, and then it's really you take it seriously to have the ISCA. Most people, how are you going to go? You have another $1 million that you can substitute. Where are you getting money? You're talking about a small amount of money. You're going to 210 net 30 of buying a washing machine, so you could have the equivalent amount. You know, it's not the substitution is easy. You know, you have the vacuum cleaner, the washing machine, the air conditioner. That's what we're talking about. Whatever that's worth, it could be $1,000. So then I could have another $1,000 to substitute, and then that becomes the iskra, and we don't know what it is, and then it's not it's not considered to be a shuas shav, that the financier is imposing on the person who got the money, because it makes sense. But when you're talking about a very large sum of money, you're talking about a house, that's the iskra, and then you say, well, in order for this to work, because we don't want to identify the iskra, but we don't gain anything by not doing so when we're dealing with a very, very expensive asset that you don't have ability to substitute for. But you're taking this seriously, this head iskra, seriously. So it really, we have a big problem, because there is some definite drawback from the standpoint of the financier, that there might be a self-evident loss, and he won't be able to get anything for that time. So it's a very, Moshe Feinstein has an idea, and in his chuvos, of how you could arrange without a head iskra. You know, you could do something else here with a mortgage. And what you could do is this, that the person who owns the home, he's getting a certain amount of down payment. Let's say he's getting 20% of the value of the home, say $200,000 he's getting. And the other $800,000 is going to be owed to him. So the way we could arrange this this way, we could have that person, the owner, is going to sell the 20% of his house. Well, 20% will be equity transferred to the buyer. He'll be the owner. And the other 80% is still going to be retained by the seller. And what the buyer will be doing is he will be paying a rent for the portion of the home that he does not own yet. And also, you know, he really, in the way banks arrange all the mortgages, that part is principal and part is interest. So the portion of the home that he does not yet own, and he's trying to acquire it, so the principal, in other words, the principal that he's paying, or there's two components of all the installments. There's principal and there's interest. So the principal would be viewed as additional acquisition of equity, that I'm acquiring more. So that's part of the payment. And instead of calling the other part as interest on the principal, we would call that as rent. You are paying that other portion as for the privilege of living in the house, that the part that you don't own. So we have two parts, and one is additional equity that you acquire, and the other is the paying rent for the portion that you don't yet own. And this continues until every period of time you are acquiring more equity, and therefore the rent is reduced, because there's a smaller portion of the value that you have not paid and is still the property of the seller, right? That's how it works. Principal and interest. So the principal thing, the way the banks work it is that in initial years, almost all the payments are classified as interest payments. So in other words, you're not acquiring additional equity in the house. And they do that, serves them well to protect them, the bank, because in case of default, they own most of the house. They you own very little of it. So they sell it, so it's their house that they're selling. In case of default, you don't pay your mortgage a couple of months, you're in trouble already. So that's how they arrange it. So this is really the same idea. Like, say, we don't never use the word interest. We don't use that word. We're looking at rent and acquisition of additional portion of the home as equity that belongs to the buyer. I'm sorry, there was a question.
If we actually wrote this in a document, like that this is going to be rent, wouldn't that, make the bank have like certain duties, to the landlord or something? Like, what would happen if you have
this is a private. This is a private mortgage between the two. The bank usually would not be a problem because it's not non-Jewish.
Would you have to stipulate those things, or like if there's certain laws, like in America, that like your county that says, in a rent situation, you have to provide the following.
Okay, see, interesting. Rabbi Blech, he talks a lot about it in one of his forums, and he says that the courts, American courts, would have it said that if what you're paying is really amounts to interest, even though you don't want to call it that, for whatever reason you have, that you would have all the advantages of interest payments, like people who can deduct interest payments on their mortgages from their taxes. So this would not say, rent you can't deduct, but interest you can. So you're doing this for religious reasons, that you want to arrange it this way, and you want to call the payments rent rather than interest. But effectively, it's the same thing. They have the same same idea in American law. So we have what's called imputed interest. 1980, they passed such a law like that, saying like this: people make an arrangement to sell an capital asset in real estate, and for a very large sum of money, and over a period of time, and there's installments, but they don't call anything the payment. None of the payments they call interest. So the government feels cheated. That they normally would get that part of it should be called interest, and they would get there would be taxes there are different advantages that the government is losing. That in fact is no, they say imputed interest. That it's as if there's interest. But here again, just like we told my Professor Resnick's Resnikoff's idea that you say that secular law would call, like you say, as he said, a non-recourse loan, and we call it shutfis. That you write that there, and that really saves you from the whole the judicial review that might say that you were a partner in this guy's venture, that he got fined by the EPA $10 million, and you're a partner. So, you know, people do worry about that. You know, so same thing here, that the whole arrangement is really one of a mortgage. And it's, you're just doing it this way and calling it interest, calling it rent rather than interest for religious purposes. That's all. So he feels that would be, you would not lose any advantages at all. But there is a big practical reason not to do this, he says, for my life. He says it's a very practical reason, because if what's happening here in this arrangement, it could be over even 20 years. What's happening is that the person who is the lessee, that is the person that's the purchaser, the person lessee, that he is acquiring part equity as the passage of time. Like every month he's getting more and more ownership in this property. So what happens if all of a sudden the lessee purchaser defaults? So anybody that's going into such an arrangement would like to have the prerogative of default. It's like, you know, then I seize the property, the collateral. The property should be collateral, and that's way I can recover some the big loan that I gave you. I mean, you can't tolerate a default one month after another. And if you're going to have this type of arrangement where the equity is building up for the, let's say, purchaser as you move through time, so when you liquidate the building, some of the proceeds of the sale will belong on a prorated basis to whom? The lessee purchaser. And from a practical standpoint, the lessor would not want this. He would be exposing himself to have this eventuality that in the case of default and there's a sale of the property, that he should have to share the proceeds, and give like a good part of the proceeds to the lessee purchaser, because he was acquiring more and more equity over the years. So this is not at all acceptable. This is a practical impediment to this whole idea. So he suggests, Rabbi Black suggests, that what could be done is very simply this. What you can do is make the whole arrangement one of rent. And the ownership is retained totally by the lessor, the one that the seller, he will retain it. And say that after a certain number of years, when the rent has been paid over, let's say, 20 years, then the property automatically transfers to the person who bought it. And until then, it's owned lock, stock, and barrel by the seller. And then in case the guy doesn't pay his rent for a couple of months and you want to sell the building, it's all your money. because he has no equity at all until the end. So the only thing is, he covers all the bases here. He says that what you can do is, this is perfectly legal to do, that you can, who does the seller want to pay the real estate taxes and everything else, all the other expenses of the house? Who has to pay that? The owner. Does he want to pay it over this 20 years, the seller? Of course not. He wants the other fellow to pay it, right? So well, he very easily arranges, like the sewer taxes and the water taxes and the property taxes, all these things, and main. So what can be done is simply this: that you have the owner of that who owns the property will be the seller, but the owner of record will be the lesser purchaser. You can do that. You can designate someone as the owner of record, even though you are the real owner. And that makes the guy that's the owner of record, he's the one that's responsible for everything, for all the taxes and everything. So you have a cake and eat it also. The building belongs, you retain ownership because you are the owner, as written in the deed that you are the owner, and it's not going to be transferred until 20 years when all these rents are paid. And then first property transfers to the lessee purchaser. And in the meantime, the owner of record is also the lessee purchaser. And this works without the headache of heter iska. So if you take it seriously, that's one point I would elaborate a little bit at Rabbi Black. He says in the beginning that, you know, that what happens if it's, you know, there's a self-evident loss, whatever. But I just need a little elaboration here that if you want to take the heter iska seriously, you can't really make a substitution for such a huge sum of such an asset that you're acquiring. It's really making a mockery out of the whole thing. You know, let somebody who's very, very wealthy, you know, so they say, oh, I have other assets, you know, other businesses. I have 10 other businesses. I have internet businesses and this and that, you know, whatever. But it's not so for most people. They that's why this is one of the most pressing reasons why people would want to go into heter iska. And that's a problem. Take it seriously. You really don't have an asset that you could substitute. You can't say, I will obligate myself, whatever the value of what the asset was when you gave it to me, I will you transact and purchase other merchandise. It doesn't ring any kind of credibility for most people, right? So this is a very good idea to use this other mechanism about he calls the leasehold agreement. I have it in the packet there, his form that he came up with. Okay, now, last thing I want to talk about is student loans. See, that apparently is a big problem. How do we arrange this? I think that there's a very proposable idea of how to make a student loan. And again, the only thing that's, as mentioned before, a mosad of Torah and Moshe Yisomim and Beis HaKnesses is only other privileges. If you're making somebody a regular loan, so you can't charge them interest. If you're just talking about an avak ribis transaction, they're permitted to make. But not derech halvog, and ribis derisis, there's no permission in here. So, now, Rav Eliashiv takes the view that we had before the idea of making a two-tier price. One, if you pay in advance, and the other, if you pay on delivery. So that is a prohibited transaction. That's of a privis. So we talk about that in respect to the magazine subscriptions. So what about for a school to make such an arrangement? A parent comes to negotiate tuition. So with school. So can the school make such a proposal? So, you know, if you pay in advance of the school year, you pay before you get any kind of educational services, that you don't have to pay, say you have to do the whole thing, because nobody pays the whole tuition. It's a $30,000 tuition. You pay in installments, right? So the question is, when is the person's loan due? After you got educational services or before? They're saying, make a deal. They're saying that if you pay in advance some of the money. And it's actually, another point to make is that we have in business very common thing called a good faith deposit. Like the whole purpose of the deposit is not advance payment. In other words, they want to be sure that you don't run away, that you're a serious customer. So the advance payment is not a good portion of the money that's due them. It's just it's like, you know what it's like equivalent to a binder on a real estate transaction. When somebody sees a house and they say they're seriously interested, they put a binder. That's not a deposit. $100 on a $1 million house is not a deposit. It's just a demonstration of seriousness that you're interested in that. And we wouldn't say there's no any kind of violation. You say you're paying $100 before you buy the house. You know, so you're not, that's not considered to be a payment before. That's just a good faith payment to show that you're serious about the transaction. That's all. So there are a lot of different things that people ask you to do that. It's just a good faith demonstration. But unless we do the tuition, that's the question. Is it the same thing as the sale of a commodity or service, and you do it that way, and then it violates Rivers law? Repayment, making, say, you pay earlier, part of it, good portion of the price, will give you a better deal. And if you pay after you start getting services, you pay installments, and it will give you a better deal if you pay before. So Eliashiv takes a view that if a school makes such an arrangement, this would not be, Ribrisky Huda brings all this whole discussion on. He said it's not equivalent to having the sale of a product or a service. This, the school administrator is regarded as a cobbler, someone as a piecework, that he arranges for you all the educational services that you need. And so he's not working on a per hour basis of fixed hours. He is a cobbler. He's agreeing to arrange for you the classrooms and the teachers and the textbooks, everything that you need. He's a cobbler. And you're paying him for providing all these services, the finished product. That's what you're paying him for. Now, there are two types of workers. There's a cobbler, the one who is paid for the finished product. And of course, there's always a deadline. A cobbler will have inevitably a deadline. Like you commission someone to make a suit for you. I want it before Yantar, so you will give him a deadline. You don't want indefinite time forever to make it, right? But the key idea is that there's flexibility, that the cobbler is not obligated to work at any fixed hours. He can work very late at night or early in the morning. Maybe he wants to work on weekends. There's this time frame that he has, and within that time frame, there's some flexibility. So the cobbler is different than Paul, who agrees to work fixed hours. In other words, it's only Paul that the Gemara says ki li avodah. He has his arrangement is akin to servitude because he's binding himself at fixed hours, where the kavlan is not. And the difference between a kavlan and a Paul in terms of is that that when it comes to a Paul, there's no kinyan until there's haschalas malacha. He begins. So we're just agreeing to work that. Does not make a kinyan. The kinyan is when he starts. So then, as I mentioned before, once the poel starts, he could say, he could say that I'll give you a break if you pay me my wages in advance. But he can't make such a stipulation before he starts, because before he starts, if he wants, he could renege on the whole deal, because there's no kinyan at all. It's just tarumos as well. At that point, and before he starts malacha, he wants to renege. He doesn't have any. He can renege, and so therefore you owe nothing. There's no firm contract, and you can't say that my schiris is due at the end. And if you pay me earlier, I'll give you a break. Nothing is due him. There's nothing firm at the point of agreement, because he yochalazor. The kinyan is. But when it comes to the kavlan, The just making kin suda, that's it. That's ready. He already is chayvus. He can't be harada because he is not. That constitutes the kinyan, his obligation to work. And once he's obligated to work, then he can just make the deal. Say, I'm only do my fee, my price when I finish. I present you the finished product. So you pay me in advance. That you could, I'll give you a break. A kabbalah is allowed to do this. So Rabbi Eliyahu says that's exactly what an educational, the administrator of the school is. Is a kabbalah, and he's allowed to make such an arrangement. Pay me before educational services. I know it's not just a chunk of that, not a good faith deposit. It's something that is substantially more than that, that would be regarded as prepayment before the services are rendered. Now, so once we go along with Rabbi Eliyahu, this idea, so if someone's in need of an educational loan, so that person is not going to be willing to pay a lot of money, a good part, let's say you have 10 installments, it's $30,000, that person will not be, soon will not be able to pay in advance. So if you set up this system for all the students, this two-tier system for advance, one total payment will be a lot less. I mean, because you want a certain interest, you want a real certain interest, you will factor this in. So if you're paying if people that don't need the loans, they can manage it. You pay, let's say, $2,000 before the school year starts. And when you add up all the installments, it's going to add up, let's say, to $30,000. But you say, if you don't want that, you cannot pay, you're not going to pay the $2,000 before. So then the whole installments is different. It's going to add up all together to, let's say, $38,000, $36,000, okay? So that's how you set it up. So someone who really is interested in not paying early and cannot afford it will say, okay, I agree to that. That I'm not going to pay before the school year starts. I will agree to this other installment plan that you have proposed, that the payments begin after the school year starts, and they even stretch out into the summer, right? You can do whatever you want. You have two types of installment plans. One, people that are willing to pay in advance, and one that are not. At least a portion of what the tuition is. Now, once the guy agrees that he's going to pay, the plan B is what I want. I don't want to pay this hefty sum before the school year starts. I want the payments to stretch out over the summer also. I want that also. They say, okay, we'll give you that plan, and we'll give you an interest-free loan to pay out this amount. And we'll give you a loan of $38,000, and we have a whole installment schedule of how to pay it out. And so that effectively allows the school to charge interest on the loan, because they have set up their tuition on two, plan A and plan B, people that essentially don't need loans and would not mind pay earlier. And when you add up their whole stream of installment payments, it adds up to say to $30,000. And then the other people who need the loans and would not think of paying such a substantial sum before the school year starts, they have a different installment plan that stretches out over a longer time and it starts after the services are rendered. But that stream adds up to much more money. Let's say to $36,000. So then $36,000, I don't have it. I'll give you a loan. And we'll give you the whole $36,000. They don't have to give it the loan in advance, but you pay anyway in installments. So we say, this is how you pay it. And the loan that we give you is to pay for plan B. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Just two announcements very quickly. I have exams here for last semester, if anyone would like to receive their exams. Also, next week's shiur will be by Rav Ben Chaim. It will be in Hebrew. And Rav Ben Chaim requested that because he's speaking in Hebrew and he doesn't know the students, fellows should please pay extra attention to look at some of the makoros in advance. I'm going to have a second.
trying to see if you can do it. Why?
I'm getting the same service. I understand what it is.
Yeah.
Because you said, that's because you said you there.
He can say, this is what I want. We don't get the school's different. That's different.
We don't like the fair market rate.
It's not making good things. It's not the school's.